Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
My life is driven by flavor. I wouldn't have the intense curiosity I do about food unless the seductress that is flavor led me into the larger rabbit hole of food studies. When you're in the restaurant business, flavor is power, and it needs to hit in the first few bites of food. But what exactly is it, and how is it created in your own head? We've been following the interests of Arielle Johnson for years. Her new book, Flavorama, is a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. Hi, Arielle. It is amazing to have you here in studio with me.
It is amazing to be here in studio with you, so thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. So what was the first moment, if you can identify it or remember, that you knew you wanted to be Dr. Flavor?
The first moment I decided I wanted to be Dr. Flavor, and this was the pathway for me. I'd already decided that chemistry and gastronomy, chemistry and cuisine, the science of cooking, was going to be my subject area, was what I was obsessed with and, you know, willing to go to grad school for, which is, no small undertaking. And the first time I read a paper about gas chromatography, mass spectrometry combined with sensory analysis, I know that's not exactly the, Proustian Madeleine moment. It was just so exciting to me that that flavor, which was something that I had always, enjoyed and chased and pursued and wanted to know more about, was actually something that you could understand with science.
And who were your culinary mentors, mm-hmm. who put you within a context that allowed you to make that leap?
So I would say indirectly, Harold McGee at first, and then more directly once I, started, met him and started moving in somewhat of the same circles. Also, my professor of chemistry, Kent Kirschenbaum at NYU, he's a biological chemist who is very, very interested in food and cuisine, and he let me do my chemistry senior thesis on Turkish stretchy ice cream and the polymer chemistry thereof. So that was very fortunate and gave me the space to, find a way to kind of weave my interests together and figure out the best way to pursue it.
I love that. Yeah. Turkish stretchy ice cream is so bizarre.
Salepdonderma, yeah.
Okay, so when I hear the word flavor scientist, my mind goes to the industrialized food world. Mm-hmm. Someone working for a big company like Kraft or Kellogg who's trying to create the next viral snack food trend. But that is not what you do. So how does your work differ from most other flavor scientists who are working today?
So yeah, most food scientists and most flavor scientists are employed by large food companies, largely because that is who there is to hire people like that and pay for the field to exist. I'm kind of at a little bit of a right angle to what they do. So, it intersects in the chemistry and in the sensory science, but I'm much more interested in understanding flavor as an everyday experience, as a expression of biology and culture and ecology and something to use in the kitchen. So I do apply it, but in a kind of different way than it is typically applied.
Are you often contacted by chefs who are trying to create something or push something farther and they need science to help them take a leap?
Yeah, often they don't necessarily know what science they need, but they know that I am good at solving problems using science. So I do get a lot of questions that often a chef has been working in one direction or another, maybe trying to do a fermentation project or, get a flavored ice to behave a certain way. And when I can, which is a lot of the time, actually, like to step in and try to cherry pick what area is it biology, is it chemistry, is it molecules reacting, is it, volatility or something like that, and set them on the right path to get what they want.
That must be eminently satisfying.
Incredibly. That's my favorite thing.
What intrigues me about flavor is how personal it can be. You know, I sat across from noted restaurant critic Jonathan Gold for a couple of decades each week, listening to him describe flavor. And I would always ask myself, is that how I perceive what he's talking about? And often in my own mind, it was, no, I'm perceiving it differently. But how interesting it is what he is perceiving. Could you speak a little bit about that, the personal nature of flavor?
Yeah, so one of the things I find most exciting and attractive about flavor is that it sits at this intersection of the extremely concrete. It's based on molecules, which we can measure, you know, real matter. The intersection of that and the personal. So, you know, flavor doesn't happen until you put something in your mouth and the signals get sent to your brain. And then, you know, from there, kind of all bets are off. But one important piece to this, the connection between flavor and the personal, is that flavor is not just taste, it is also smell. Smell is a huge, huge essential part of flavor. And smell, more than any of our other senses, is deeply tied, really in a physical, neurological way, to our emotions and memories. Once we gather smell molecules and build a smell signal and kind of pass it to the rest of the brain, the first place that it goes is the limbic system and places like the amygdala, places where we keep our most emotional, personal memories and associations. So with smell, and therefore with flavor, we'll often have our personal history, our emotional reaction to it, come up before we even can recognize or articulate what it is that we are smelling and tasting.
And it's so interesting to me that these days, on social media in particular, where people are constantly giving their takes on whatever they're eating, the latest restaurant thing, whatever, and it's always within these parameters of better or worse, and yet none of us who are not scientists, I think very few of us have spent the time to actually parse what it is we like and why.
I think that's true. I mean, I think science also has really nothing to say about questions of aesthetics and taste. Taste in the philosophical sense, not the physiological sense. You know, what is the ultimate? What is the best? These are subjective questions, and science can enhance that understanding, but can't really tell us what it is. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, whether we think about what we like and why we like it, a lot of that is social and cultural. It's the kind of thing where if you get into the habit of doing it, you get much better at it.
So let's get into the science. What is flavor?
Flavor is a composite sense, combining mostly taste and smell, as well as some, you know, information from all the other senses. But taste and smell are the two big ones.
And so taste, meaning sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami,
yes,
is something a lot of people know about. But let's focus on smell, which is, as you said, much more complicated. In the book, you say, right now as you read this, you have brain cells dangling out of the bottom of your skull, exposed to the air inside your nose at all times, and we all walk around like this is totally normal.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know that is how it works. I know it's a real thing. And still, like, every time I think about it, it blows my mind that that is how smell works. So, yeah, we have neurons that are attached on one end to a structure called the olfactory bulb in our brain. And then those neurons, those brain cells, pass through a small holes in the base of our skull and just kind of hang out, waiting to grab onto smell molecules on the in the inside of our nasal cavity.
Amazing, amazing. You compare smell to a QR code. What do you mean by that?
So it's probably best understood by comparing it to taste. With taste, we have very distinct matches between specific molecules, specific receptors, and specific perceptions. When you taste something sour, for example, acid molecules will go onto your tongue. They will interact with the sour receptor, which pretty much only interacts with them and with nothing else. And the signal that gets sent to your brain is like pressing a key on a piano. So sour, loud and clear, very, very simple, very one-directional. With smell, we don't have a finite set of smells the way we do with tastes. We have, you know, the five basic tastes. With smell, we have about 400 different types of receptors, and the way that we collect smell information is that rather than having these one-to-one pairings like acid to sour receptor and sugar to sweet receptor, all volatile smell molecules can interact with like several of these different 400 different receptors, and any receptor might grab onto, you know, a few or dozens of molecules in a different way.
So walk us through how this all goes down in real life. Let's pick, for example, a ripe tomato, right? We pick it off the vine, it's still warm from the sun, and we take a bite.
First, you notice on your tongue, you know, the acids, the sweetness, the umami. Then some of the volatile smell molecules leave the tomato that's in your mouth, and rather than, you know, go through your nostrils like sniffing, they'll actually travel up the back of your throat. They'll float through the air and enter your nose through the back door, essentially. So we call that retronasal olfaction, to contrast it to orthonasal olfaction, which is, you know, sniffing something in front of your face. And from there, this blend of probably a few dozen different types of aroma molecules will float up and attach to an area at the roof of your nasal cavity called the olfactory epithelium. This is where all the smell receptors stick out of. So a bunch of different molecules all kind of in a soup impact this sort of sticky surface with 400 different types and shapes of catcher's mitt sticking out. And, you know, some of them will grab on to a few molecules very hard and send a very strong signal. Some will send a milder signal. But by getting, you know, this blend of smell molecules that correspond to tomato, all impacting your olfactory receptors at the same time, they send, you know, each of them their own distinct signal to this olfactory bulb, this structure in your brain, and generate what in, you know, neuroscience and psychology we would call an odor image. So it is basically like a two-dimensional graph of, you know, 400 different lights lighting up to different degrees. So the pattern that it generates is, you know, essentially similar to a square QR code that corresponds to the sum that is greater than the sum of its parts of all of these components of tomato aroma.
So amazing. So you have rules for flavor,
yes.
Some rules for flavor that you list in the book. And I think the one that is the most useful for home cooks is the fact that flavor follows predictable patterns, and that if people understand the patterns, then they can unlock the ability to improvise. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to train your palate to become attuned?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people, when they, you know, when I'm talking to them and they hear that I study flavor, they're like, oh, I have such a bad palate, I could never do that. The fact is that most humans are very, very good at distinguishing differences between flavors. We're just very bad at naming them. Fortunately, we can learn how to do that with practice. So most of us are just not in practice or out of practice. I've actually, you know, in my academic career back in the day, trained a few dozen people to become very precise analytical tasters. And, you know, what we do in the lab, you can essentially replicate, you know, on a simpler level at home. It's really just a process of smelling and tasting things very carefully, paying attention, trying to name any associations that you have, and then basically just doing this over and over again. When I was doing this, we would do it on wine a lot because I was in the wine department at UC Davis. So if you smell a red wine and you're a sensory subject and you think you smell raspberry, what we'll do then as scientists is go out and get maybe three different versions of raspberry, like fresh raspberry, frozen raspberry, and raspberry jam. So all of those are raspberry, but like in a kind of different way. We'll then like put them in front of you and ask you to smell and taste all of them and then tell us, all right, when you say raspberry, like which raspberry do you mean? And then, you know, from then on, we use that particular example of raspberry as our fixed reference in real life. So not to go off on a long tangent, but simply just smelling and tasting ingredients when you find them and when you're working with them. And, you know, occasionally tasting things side by side, sort of like a beer flight or a wine flight. You could do that with any type of ingredient, herbs, olive oil, fruits, things like that. And just getting into the habit of paying attention and trying to name what you are experiencing. Most people are bad at it at first, and it feels, you know, very out of our comfort zones and uncomfortable, but eventually, like, you will get very good at it.
Okay, so the next thing I'm going to ask you to read after I ask you the question. Ooh. So I'm going to ask you the question, what is meat? You have that fantastic thing, a network of mostly unflavored protein soaked in water.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I just found this so, like, perfect and awesome. All right.
The flavorless but textually interesting sponge.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's get into specific ingredients. What is meat?
Meat, from the perception of a flavor scientist, is a mostly flavorless but texturally interesting sponge of proteins soaked full of water with a relatively tiny amount of flavor-active molecules in it.
And then the meaty, those flavor molecules are like precursors, and they create meaty flavor once that meat is cooked.
Yeah, so if you smell ground beef or taste beef tartare from a, you know, restaurant or a supplier that is reputable enough to give you raw meat, you know, you'll notice it doesn't taste like beefy, like beef stew necessarily, or cooked meat. So that beefy flavor really doesn't exist until you start heating up the meat, and different ions and enzymes and things like that interact with things like cell membrane lipids and free amino acids and stuff like that. Stuff that's floating around. And once all these components meet and get shaken up in the heat, they'll make these very beefy flavored molecules that is the flavor of meat that we know and love.
So, and I'm asking this because you say that meat has relatively few flavor molecules. So objectively, do vegetables have more flavor than meat from a molecular standpoint?
Yeah, in terms of raw product, vegetables have a lot more flavors than raw meat, definitely.
Okay, spice. Well,
spice.
We're here in LA, right? You had a burrito for breakfast.
I did.
Why do different versions of chilies hit differently?
In terms of spiciness, chilies have a very, very spicy molecule in them called capsaicin. And chilies can hit differently because different varieties produce, you know, sometimes a million times more than other varieties. So the range of spicy in chilies is pretty much a one-to-one correspondence with the concentration of this molecule capsaicin that they make. And some chilies, like a habanero or, you know, scorpion, naga viper, some of these, you know, really, really intense ones, might make thousands of times more of capsaicin, the spicy molecule, than something like a poblano pepper would.
So the flavor itself is intimately related to the pain molecules.
Yes. So the kind of weird and fun thing about spicy is that it feels like a taste, but it is not actually a taste because we do not sense it with our taste buds. We sense it with a pain receptor. So technically, spicy is a part of touch.
Wow. I love that. So my sous chef and I worked for decades together, and she has this family recipe from Sicily that combines lamb cut into small pieces with butter and rosemary that's braised. It's unlike any meat sauce I've ever had. The combination of the butter and the meat and the rosemary, it's just greater than the sum of its parts. Is it because the butter interacts with the meaty flavors in a way that allows the flavors to be available differently?
So butter is both kind of a source of its own flavor, but also a very good carrier for other flavors, especially aromas. Everyone knows oil and water don't mix, right? So taste molecules are much more like water molecules. Smell molecules, on the other hand, are chemically much more similar to oil molecules, fat molecules. The practical takeaway of this is that flavors tend to dissolve much better in fats than they do in water. So if you combine flavorful, in this case, you know, meaty, herbal ingredients with a fat, in this case butter, and give it time to kind of extract and infuse and mingle, you're essentially creating a cozy infused blanket of all of the flavors. So the fat will really help bring those flavors out, make them more pronounced, but also sort of combine together into a holistic flavor experience that you wouldn't get if you were to, you know, cook these things separately and then combine them together later.
Mm. So in order to create flavor, we have to physically create it during the process of cooking. And when we're concentrating, extracting, or infusing ingredients to exploit their flavors, how much actual space do the flavor molecules take up?
Yeah, so this was shocking for me to learn initially that if you were weighing out the components of any type of ingredient, the taste molecules might be like a few percent of the total weight, but then the aroma molecules would not even register on the scale. We measure these things in flavor science in parts per million and below. So we are, on the one hand, exquisitely sensitive to aroma compounds. We only need a tiny, tiny amount to get a quite intense sensation. But on the other hand, they are, you know, for all of the huge sensory impact they have, really a infinitesimally tiny part of any ingredient on a sort of, you know, molecular level.
Amazing. So when you say like dissolves like, what do you mean?
So, back to you know, oil and water not mixing. This has to do with a property called polarity, which has to do with a blanket of electrons around around these different molecules, and they're shaped differently for water than for oil, basically. But what that means is that every other molecule can basically be measured in terms of how much more like water or oil it behaves. And the molecules that behave more like oil are much more happy to dissolve in oil. So oil and fats, really good for dissolving smell molecules and spicy, actually. Whereas the like dissolving like in the case of taste molecules is very much water. So things like salts and acids and sugars have a much easier time hanging out with water than they do with an oil or a fat.
So for some unknown reason, I have about 2 pounds of cocoa nibs in my pantry.
Nice. It's a good problem to have.
You gave me the gift in your book of cocoa nib lemon butter.
Yes.
So how do we make it and what do we do with it?
So cocoa nib lemon butter is a compound butter. It's a recipe I wrote to kind of highlight and showcase how good fat is as a carrier of aromas specifically. You know, any compound butter is really about taking some kind of flavorful solid ingredient and folding it together with butter and letting it hang out for a little while. With cocoa nib and lemon butter, you get these deep roasted fruity notes from the cocoa nibs, some bitterness, and also this very light, sprightly, heady citrus flavor from lemon zest. And the nice thing about compound butter is, well, it's easy to make, and by, you know, giving these aromatic, flavorful ingredients a chance to hang out with the butter for a little while, you'll get something that is kind of infused with the character of the flavors, but also has these kind of intense pops of it. So it's a dynamic eating experience that I really like.
It's really interesting because, the reason I have so many cocoa nibs is that I really love making biscotti with cocoa nibs. And so I think I'm going to make that butter and then use the butter in the recipe.
That sounds delicious.
You.
Yeah. Well, and that's like exactly the kind of thinking I hope people take away from reading about flavor, is that basically anytime you're cooking and bringing ingredients together, you have an opportunity to bring them together in a more flavorful, more delicious way. So basically anytime you're adding fat to a recipe, whether it's butter or oil or anything like that, if you combine it with the flavorful ingredients early on, you'll get a much more intense, round, well-infused flavor. So yeah, making this compound butter and then using the butter to make the biscotti, you'll get, I think, probably quite a different taste experience than not doing it that way. But I'm excited to hear how the experiment works for you.
Yeah, I can't wait to try. So now we're kind of going to do not really a speed round, but kind of.
Okay.
I just picked a bunch of stuff that just sounds delicious to me at random. Tell me about your peanut Russian.
Oh yeah, peanut Russian. It's my take on a white Russian, which of course is coffee liqueur and half and half, basically. If you watch the Big Lebowski, or I don't know if people still drink them regularly. I like them a lot. Basically, this idea of an alcoholic beverage that's got this kind of like deep coffee, bitter brownness, and a lot of creaminess. But in this case, instead of a dairy product, you use peanut milk, which is basically like making soy milk, but with peanuts instead of soybeans. So it's extracting all of the flavor of the peanut into this like creamy, quote unquote, milk, and then using a coffee infused rum in the place of a Kahlua to make a, you know, really creamy, nutty, also vegan cocktail experience.
Sounds so good to me. Clove and allspice pickled marmalade.
Mm-hmm. This is pretty similar to marmalade, which you know use pieces of orange essentially to make a bittersweet jam. In this case, there's some vinegar to brighten it up, and also large pieces of clove and allspice that you cook together with the marmalade and leave in after you pour it into the jar. So the longer that you let it sit, the more these sweet, spicy aromas infuse the entire jar of jam.
And are you using it like a sweet jam or more like a chutney?
Yeah, more like a chutney or an orange marmalade. I mean, you could, since it has a lot of intense flavors, it has a lot of acidity, you know, in addition to sweetness and some bitterness. I tend to use it a bit more like a chutney or a membrillo than a straightforward jam.
So you're eating it with cheese.
I love eating it with cheese.
Why are you a fond evangelist? Someone who goes so far as to cook giant trays of chicken that you're then going to dispose of because you have stabbed it so many times to let the juices flow out and caramelize on the pan.
So the fond is, you know, as you say, when you're cooking a piece of meat and the juices leak out, basically they make this brown layer that sticks to the pan. And this is, to me, the perfect concentrated essence of meatiness. So whenever I brown a piece of meat or I'm trying to make gravy or roasting a piece of meat, I always deglaze the pan and find a way to incorporate the fond, the, you know, browned meaty parts into either the meat itself or into a sauce. So at previous Thanksgivings when we've grilled our turkey and we're not roasting it in a pan, so did not have a fond, I did not want terrible gravy. I think fond is essential for good gravy. So we roasted sheet pans of chicken drumsticks that I stabbed all over while they were cooking, which you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to, you know, stick your knife too many times into a piece of meat to check because it'll let the juices run out. In this case, I wanted the juices to run out because I wanted them to kind of collect on the pan and make a extra, extra large fond to use wherever I wanted, in this case, delicious gravy.
Such a great idea.
In my defense, I didn't actually throw the drumsticks away. I did use them to make a light stock. But in this case, you're really, you know, taking that flavorless sponge and separating it from the meat juice, which you get to experience then as its own, like, concentrated essence.
Does texture have anything to do with flavor? Is it just a bonus?
No, texture is a huge part of flavor. You know, the texture of salt grains, for example, can have a really significant impact on how salty you perceive a salt to be. Things like astringency in red wine. So if you, you know, drink a young red wine and it kind of makes the inside of your mouth feel like sandpaper, you'll have a bit of a different flavor experience overall than if you were just drinking it without tannin.
And is that because the tannins are actually having a physical effect on the surface of your tongue?
Yeah, so actually not on the surface of your tongue. your entire mouth is lubricated with saliva. Sorry for saying lubricated and saliva. I know those are gross words. Lubricated with saliva. And what makes saliva a good lubricant in this case is because it has different types of proteins, sometimes what are called glycoproteins, floating around in it. Tannins, which are, you know, groupings of polyphenols that make red wine red and other, you know, fruits and flowers, the colors that they are, will actually react with the proteins and pull them out of solution. So it'll actually make your saliva a much less efficient lubricant. Basically, astringency is the unmediated feeling of your tongue touching the inside of your mouth. It's
I love that. I love that. Oh God, this is such a nerd fest. It's just the greatest thing ever. Do you think that one reason why a lot of good restaurant food happens is because chefs take advantage of opportunities to create layered flavor? They take the time to do that, whereas at home, we just want to feed ourselves?
Absolutely. You know, in a restaurant, since you are doing all of your prep in advance and then executing many dishes over the course of a night, the structure is really set up that allows you to pre-make or pre-prep a lot of different components and then bring them together on the final plate. So I'd say, yeah, the biggest difference between really complex tasting restaurant food and home cooking is this sort of singular focus on making each component as flavorful as possible, often regardless of how inefficient and time consuming that is.
Yeah. So this is where all of the infusions, extractions, dehydrated situations come into
fermentation,
play.
Fermentation, things like that. Yeah, if you want to, you know, start your prep months before you're going to eat a dish.
Like at Noma.
Exactly.
Okay, we have to talk about pie because, you know that we're kind of pie obsessed.
I love pie.
And specifically apple pie, we have a big contest coming up in a few weeks, and there are two apple categories this year. How is the flavor of an apple transformed by heat?
So when you heat up smell molecules, since those molecules are volatile, they, you know, are able to basically spend time as a gas and float through the air. Once you heat them up, they will start to essentially boil off and dissipate. So, you know, this is how like a reed diffuser or one of those like candle rings that you put essential oils into work. You heat up smell molecules and they'll go up into the air more. They won't all do it at the same, you know, rate and to the same degree. So when you cook apples, heat up pieces of fruit, but specifically apples, you'll tend to boil off some of the kind of lighter tutti-frutti and green top notes. And what you're left with are a lot of, you know, what a perfumer might call the base notes, the physically and chemically heavier smell molecules that, in the case of apples, have this really decadent, plush, you know, rose petal, cooked fruit, caramel, tobacco character. That's, you know, one of my favorite flavors.
Oh my God. They're called the greatest description.
My favorite apple molecule is called beta damascenone, and it is a norisoprenoid. It's one of these apple base notes.
Do you ever make perfume?
I do a bit. I kind of have backburnered it a little bit just as I've been working on this book, but fragrance and flavor are like chemically basically the same thing. We use them for different things, but we're just talking about blends of smell molecules. So things like perfumery are basically a chance to compose with pure smell. So one interesting thing about perfumery, you're not working with whole ingredients. You're generally working with essential oils and extracts and things like this. But there are several different techniques for removing aroma molecules from different materials. Again, an essential oil is not the same thing as an absolute. An essential oil is a steam distillation. An absolute is a solvent extraction, which, you know, sounds like a fairly academic point. But basically, different techniques express different facets of these complex aromas. So it's very interesting for me to work with a lot of these materials for perfumery and kind of get these very different expressions and personalities of familiar ingredients like a rose petal or a citrus.
Wow. Okay, so going back to that apple pie, mm-hmm. Do you have any advice on how to enhance the flavor of an apple pie?
Yes. One is to enhance the flavor of the apples themselves by trying to induce chemical reactions that will create more flavors than the apples already have. So if you were to roast or caramelize the apples a little bit, or if not all of the apples, some of the apples beforehand, you'll be introducing more flavor molecules into the pie, literally. If you include any fats or butter in the cream in the filling itself, let the apples and the spices mingle together with any fat, you know, for maybe a day in the fridge before you put them all together, and you'll get this much more permeated, infused flavor expression of all of those things. If you wanted to go crazy, you could enhance the apple flavor of the apple filling by using a bit of apple molasses, which is really just reduced apple juice or apple cider. So if you juice some of the apples and simmer it very gently until you make a syrup, you'll get essentially super concentrated essence of apple that you can then really beef up the apple pie with.
That's what I do.
Oh, great. Great minds think alike, I guess.
Yeah, there are a couple apple farms that make an exceptional, like, cider extract.
Yeah, boiled cider.
Boiled cider. It's so delicious.
Well, and I think that's a great example of thinking about the science of flavor. It doesn't have to feel like a organic chemistry class. It can be just a little enhancement to your existing culinary intuition. So I'm glad you already figured that one out.
Okay, so now let's talk about pumpkin. What is your go-to spice blend for a pumpkin pie?
So I'm really interested in not just the flavor of spices, but also the like history and cultural usage. So some people might know, some people might not, that European Western cuisine used to be much more spicy. We would put a lot more spices in even savory foods in a way that we don't tend to see now. Small vestiges like add nutmeg to your spinach or some sort of sweet spice blends for like terrines and things like that. But basically, if you went back to like the Middle Ages, you'd be putting all kinds of spices in every single dish if you were living in Europe. And some of those...
Oh, okay. I just want to interject here. I feel like when all of these foods from the Americas came over to Europe, particularly tomatoes, it wiped all that out.
That's an interesting hypothesis.
I think because of the they had a different kind of acidity and sweetness.
Definitely. It was a big flavor game changer.
Yeah, huge. Yeah. Because like with Italian food, the history of Italian food, you see it so clearly.
Right.
I mean, everything was white and spiced, heavily spiced. And then everything became red and the spices went away.
And everything was fresh and tangy and umami.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. Let's get back to the
pumpkin spices. I'm sorry. I've never thought about that. And I'm fascinated. So if you went back to the Western Middle Ages, not only were people using more spices, they were using spices that are not in common usage in Western cuisine anymore. A lot of these are like relatives of spices that we do use. So black pepper has relatives like long pepper and cubeb pepper that, you know, have a black pepper-like character, but are aromatic in different ways than typical black pepper. And then the cardamom family, you know, we usually use green cardamom if we're using it in baking, but has the cardamom is actually closely related to ginger, weirdly. But there's other members of this family like Ethiopian cardamom, also called Korarima, and grains of paradise that have not exactly the same flavors as cardamom, but are sort of interesting interpretations of the genre. So looking at spice usage in the past is, you know, not only an opportunity for more places to add spices, but also more spices to use. So, long tangent, sorry. I like to make a pumpkin pie spice with some of these underutilized, now underappreciated relatives of some more common spices. So it includes grains of paradise and Ethiopian cardamom. So it's kind of hits the sweet spot of it's a familiar, sweet, fragrant, spicy thing, but with a twist. So it's a nice mix of novelty and familiarity that keeps people excited.
Sounds so delicious. And I would love to make a chai masala using some of those.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Yeah.
Because I use chai masala in my pumpkin pie instead of, quote, pumpkin pie spices.
I have also done that. I think it's a, I mean, the, you know, the standard pumpkin pie spices, I guess, what, like ginger, nutmeg.
Cinnamon.
And a little, like, clove, perhaps?
Maybe. Sometimes clove, yeah.
Yeah, so you're, you know, you probably don't get as much allspice. You definitely don't include cardamom. Yeah, there's just so much more complexity and depth of flavor and excitement that you can add by branching out a little bit from these, the four spices you'd find in your the back of your mom's spice cabinet.
The blend you find in the grocery store.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly.
If you can exhort us to take on board one technique at home to create more flavor, what would it be?
I think one of the easiest ways to embrace this is to embrace the Maillard reaction. The Maillard reaction is a reaction between amino acids, so like the building blocks of proteins, and sugars. But chemistry aside, it is the source of all of the browned, toasted, roasted flavors in things like chocolate, coffee, roasted meat, chicken skin, toast, brown butter, things like this. So it's a reaction that has many different faces. You know, chocolate doesn't taste the same as coffee, although they're both sort of brown tasting. And really the easiest way to you know, use this to add extra layers of flavor to whatever you're cooking is to heat up any ingredients that you have, whether that's butter or a piece of meat, so that these things have a chance to react with each other and to, you know, as much as possible, do things like dab the outside of meat before you sear it so that there isn't as much water, so that the water doesn't absorb all of the heat. The heat can go into the meat and then create this delicious browning reaction. So a lot of the, you know, the precursors, the building blocks for this stuff is just hanging out in the ingredients that we're using all of the time. And all you have to do is be a little bit clever about how you're applying heat to them, and you'll, you know, reap all of these flavor rewards.
Thank you so much, Arielle.
Thank you so much. This was a super fun conversation. I wish it could go longer.
That was flavor scientist Arielle Johnson. Her new book is Flavorama, a guide to unlocking the art and science of flavor. For a recipe from the book, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You can tell I really loved the book.